Okay, welcome back, everybody. It is now 10:20, and we are Wednesday the 17th, and we are picking up where we left off. We're still in chapter 1. Hopefully, we're going to finish chapter 1 today. That's my goal, and then we'll be moving on to chapter 2 tomorrow. We'll see. There's a lot to finish here yet. There's a lot to unpack in this chapter 1, because they put all of the computation component, which is sort of foundational for everything that we do the rest of the semester, and I feel like a lot of the things that we've been talking about were also important in regards to getting a shared vocabulary and making sure that that we understood these terms that we're going to use as we go forward. But this next part is we slip into 1.5. 1.5 does measurement and uncertainty, and this is what we've been dealing with in the lab for the last two days, and even today, which is good because that means that we can speed through this a little bit more. There's, I think, four people that are in lab that are not in lecture. Well, let's see. Now, how many people are in lecture but not in lab? There might be a good number of people, so I'll have to be a little bit careful. And I may really ask for your input in this as we move forward as to how quickly I can move through this next section. It will be a bit redundant for those people who are in lab, but we'll see. We'll see how fast we can move. I move at the pace of the class and as fast as we can for good comprehension. So I'm not one to try to just push to get through material. I'm one to make sure that we have good comprehension. I'd rather have that than just moving fast. So I want to make sure that we're all on the same page as we move forward. What is the deadline for joining lab? That's a good question that I don't have an answer to. Usually I think it's within the first week that it becomes more difficult to join lab after the first week. However, you can attend lab, continue to attend lab, and if we find we need to do a late add, there are ways that we can go through and do a late add even after the adding period has closed. So as long as you are continuing to attend and then you find that you need it, then we can get through and do that. Kerrigan, did I send out add codes? I did not. What I did is I went in and did administrative permissions within WebAdvisor and made it so that everybody who was seeking to add the class was then able to go into WebAdvisor and just add it directly without an add code. That way add codes weren't passing around or getting confused. It just made things easier. So I thought that I had emailed everybody letting them know that I had given them permission. Check your email, see if I did indeed give you permission. If I did not, please email me again. I'll go in and I'll fix it quickly and give you permission to add that lab. And let me know what lab you want to add. People were saying, yes, add me to the lab. And I'm like, well, wait, which one? There's morning and there's afternoon. You got to choose one. So send me those two things. I need a student ID. I need to know what lab section you want to add. And then I can go in and I can give you the administrative permission to add the lab section. All right. And then I email you back and let you know that I've done it. So that's the other thing that I've been doing regularly. Any other questions people want to check in with really quick as we're doing sort of like an administrative check-in this morning? This is a good time to do this. This is our third day of lecture. We're sort of getting in the rhythm of things. And so just catching up with any of those questions. I sent out an email late last night. Many of you, I'm expecting, probably got that this morning if you check your email regularly. And that is that I launched the Canvas shell. Can you go over what homework is due this week? Yes. So I launched that Canvas shell last night. The Canvas shell has one module in it that is the module for chapter one. And in that module, it has a suggested reading. It has a suggested homework from the book with problems delineated out with each one of the sections, 1.1 through 1.6. It also then has a homework assignment in Canvas that looks very much like a quiz, but it is what is called a formative assignment. It is lower point values. I think it's 10 points for that homework assignment. And it gives you three trials to go through it. So if you get things wrong through it, you can go back through it again to improve your grade. It will take the highest of the three grades of the three times that you go through and do that assignment. And it also gives you feedback for wrong answers on how to go back and check your answer and see what you might have done wrong. So it has a lot of feedback when you get an answer wrong. And then that homework assignment I was going to have due tomorrow night. And then I have a quiz that I would like you to do by Friday night. So there is on Canvas a Canvas homework. This is similar to a quiz. It's 10 points. It's due by midnight tomorrow night. And then there is a quiz for this week. That quiz is also on Canvas, and that quiz is a 20-point quiz. I think it gives you two chances to go through and do that quiz. So you've got two chances to go through and do that Canvas quiz. 20 points, that one is due midnight on Friday. And they're all set up in there so that you can easily see where they're located. Canvas says the quiz is locked until June 18th. What? Yeah, it might be. Maybe I need to go in and unlock it. What I did was I put a due date on it, but I did not put a termination date on it, and I put no penalty for late submission. So these are suggested deadlines to try to keep you on track. But if you fall behind for some reason or you need an extension for some reason, the quiz will stay open, as will the homework. And I think I probably locked the quiz just because I wanted you to be able to do the homework first, and then I would pop the quiz up tomorrow. It'll pop up there fairly quickly so that you can do it by Friday. And what else do I need to tell you? So there's no late penalty for finishing it late, and it will not go away. So the quiz will still be there, which will give you an opportunity to finish it if you need an extension or time in order to be able to go in and finish those things. So don't fret about that. Nathan, when will we know everything we need to know for the Friday quiz? Hopefully by the end of today. And the homework that is in the book at this point is optional. So yes, what I have done, but I would say very good practice, because what I did is I focused my homework in Canvas and I focused the quiz on the numerical components, while the homework also covers some of the terminology and the other chapters that we have been doing. So I would say that yes, it is suggested, but it is highly suggested to do the homework that is in the textbook. And that I would think that that would be part of your evening routine from now on. And I will keep each beginning of the week, I will put together a new homework assignment and have that ready for the entire week so that you can find your pacing, so that you don't have to go through and do it all at once, so that you can do it section by section as we go. No, Sabra, at this point, we will not turn in the suggested homework. At this point, I'm just going to leave it suggested, and I'm going to try to create individual Canvas homework assignments that will be shorter and give you the point values rather than trying, because it's going to be very difficult for me to try to assess and grade for 90 students the homework that you guys are going to be feeding in and give you the comments that you deserve to get back on that. So I don't think at this point I plan on having you hand that in. I'm going to have you hand in specific assignments that won't be the exact homework assignments, but they will be both things that I put together in Canvas and maybe some other assignments that I ask you to do on paper, take a cell phone shot of, send it in and put it in on Canvas. And then I will go in and actually edit it with my iPad and give you handwritten comments back so that you can see the handwritten comments. But that's down the road. That we're still going to work on that. We're doing baby steps here. We've got the Canvas shell up and running. And I was just excited about that because this is my first foray with Canvas, and I'm still hating it, but I'm maybe hating it a little bit less. that's sort of what it is. Okay, what else do we need to do? Any other questions that are coming up? This is good today just to try to adjust all of these things. How is the format working out for everybody? Everybody is finding the recordings okay, or if they're using the recordings or not using the recordings, that's sort of up to you. I think that the lecture format and my ability to communicate in this format using the iPad is seeming to work out all right. The lab seems to be going okay. Organization, I'm hearing from Nathan, is being Good, great format. Okay, as long as this is working for everybody, the only thing that I feel that I'm missing, that I really miss, is the gelling of the class that normally happens in this summer class, in that I strongly encourage people to work in groups, and this format does not allow for working in groups, which is a hard component. It's very difficult to study chemistry, and this is something that I want to talk about for a second, because I think it is important in finding a way to be able to work with other people, and maybe taking advantage of particularly the STEM MESA Center may be one way to get around this. It is difficult to do chemistry on your own. It is a very challenging subject to study by yourself, and that it is motivational to find people to get together with, to sit and work with. And so maybe part of that is finding time to join in on one or two of those Zoom chats a week with the STEM and MESA Center. Even if you don't need help, there may be other students in the class that can join together, and you can form like a little pod where you can work together, or at least communicate together on Zoom, and ask questions of each other in order to keep each other motivated and stimulated and moving forward. And that can be a really powerful thing. In person, without COVID, without all this stuff, I highly recommend it. It is one of the things, one of the ways that people get through STEM is with their peers. And so this format really limits us in that capability. And I feel that strongly. And I assume, I'm sure that you guys feel that strongly too. So that's one of the best ways that I can think to try to get that element back into the class. The other thing is, I'm going to keep a question and answer chat running within Canvas. And so if you find that you're working and you're stuck on something, throw it into the chat, see if one of your peers can answer it, or if I can answer it quicker. We'll see who of us can get to it the quickest. But also don't forget that my email is there, and that I'm really pretty quick on email. I think people who have emailed me have found that I'm turning it around probably within a minute or two in most cases. And worst case scenario, if it's late at night, I might get to it the next morning. But I'm certainly pretty quick on email unless I'm actually in class. Okay. I think that's all of my news and updates. Let's see what we need to do today and jump into today's session. All right, so we're doing more on numbers and measurement. We're into section 1.5. So this is section 1.5. Which glasses am I wearing? Not the glasses I want. So this is section 1.5. And this is measurement and uncertainty. And this is the part that we've been doing the majority of in lab. So we have spent the last couple of days dealing with measurement and uncertainty. And I felt like between this morning's lab and yesterday afternoon lab, we have covered almost all of this material that is in section 1.5. And so everything that we're going to do here is just pretty much a check-in and a review, and then see if we need to do anything supplemental to add to this. Let me start by this. This is one thing that we have not addressed in lab yet. So this isn't probably one of the most important parts, and I haven't addressed it in lab, and I don't know why I skipped this over, but classification of values. There's two different types of values. In the two different types of values, we have measured and exact. And so this is something that we haven't addressed, which is really actually quite critical to address. Measured and an exact. In a measured value, we are using a measuring device, some ruler or gauge or something. So this is obtained with a measuring device, with a ruler or scale. And because of that, it contains uncertainty. And the way that we've been dealing with that uncertainty is we have used the system of significant figures. And we'll look at that in a little bit more detail, but we've got that part there. So anything that is measured is always going to have a degree of uncertainty with it. And so that's going to relay into any sort of calculations that I do with those measured values. The result is going to have to take into account the level of uncertainty of the data that is going into that calculation. But then there are a couple of types of numbers that are exact that don't have uncertainty. So these exact types of values, there are two different types of these. And maybe before I put these two different types in, maybe I need to, let's just take this and take it over this way. These exact values are do not contain a level of uncertainty. They have no uncertainty. These are exact in that they have no sig figs. Or another way to say this is we treat them as if they have infinite sig figs. And these two different types of numbers are definitions. And counted values. So a definition. Definition is a unit of measure that is defined within a system. For instance, a definition, an example of definitions are that there are 1,000 milliliters equals 1 liter. It is defined that there are exactly 1,000 milliliters in a liter. There is no plus or minus. It is an exact definition. Another exact definition is that there are 100 centimeters in 1 meter, or that there are 12 inches in 1 foot. That these are exact definitions, and there is no uncertainty in the definition itself. So the 1,000, the 100, the 12 are exact values without any degree of uncertainty in them. The other type, counted values. A counted value is a whole number that has no possibility of having a fraction. So these are whole numbers with no possibility of a fraction. Examples of these would be counting objects. Like if I were to count 3 cans, I can't have a half of a can. I either have a whole can or not. 21 pens. There's no possibility of getting half a pen. They come in one unit and there's no possibility of dividing a pen up into anything else. 4 cars. You either have a whole car or you don't have a car. It's a counted value where, because of the way that we're counting them, they're not being measured, they're being counted. And there are many different types of values within chemistry that are counted values that are not measured. And they are exempt of sig figs because of the way that they are counted, because they come in whole values and there's no possibility of having any degree of uncertainty within the counted value. So we have these two different types. We have exact, which are definitions, and counted values. And then we have measured values, and the measured values are the ones that have uncertainty and the ones that we need to be careful of. So so let's take a look at this point. This is where we get a little redundant with lab, and I just want to check in. And take in maybe. Second. Is there a question?
Oh, I'm sorry, could you scroll up for one more second?
Sure.
Thank you.
Could do it that way, so it's zoomed out a little bit. Are we good?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, so with that, what we can do is we can look at, let's just do a quick check in here. Let's say that I have 2.73 milliliters and, let's say that I have 3 feet equals 1 yard. Let's do a value of 10 to the sixth microliters equals 1 liter. Let's do 102.73 grams, 2.54. Oh, I think I talked about this before. 2.54 centimeters equals 1 inch. And let's do another one. 3.785 liters equals 1 gallon. Okay. Oh, I need some more exact ones. Let me do, now that I give it away, that yeah, the next one's going to be an exact one. Let's do 15 students. Or maybe I have 172 graduated. No, let's just do apples. That works. Counted or measured? Or let's do exact or measured. Let's do it that way. So exact or measured, first one, let's do them alphabetical. A, B, C, D. What about A? Exact or measured? Measured. Okay, good. Check. What about B? B is exact. I'm seeing it come through by a few people. Good. If I hit one that you don't understand, throw it out there quick. 10 to the sixth microliters equals 1 liter. Exact. Good. D, 102.73 grams. Measured. Okay. Ooh, I got one more to throw in here. 173 grams. Okay, so where are we? We're on E. Be careful on E. 2.54 centimeters equals 1 inch. Okay, I'm seeing answers and they're correct. And I'm wondering if they're correct. I'm wondering why they're correct. And I'm wondering, and I'm seeing a couple that are measured that are not. This one is exact. And I think I talked about this yesterday. Did not we spend time talking about how they took, in fact, I'm going to go back to yesterday, chem lecture, and where I talked about the SI system and where I made this measurement. Where did I do it? Density. Ah, I don't see it. I know I talked about it. And I know I'm just zooming through pages. That's not going to be helpful. We talked about the foot and how there's an imperial foot and how there's the new definition of the foot and how that's used in surveys and how they went through. And when they looked at 2.54 centimeters equals 1 inch, that they found that it was 2.54000000 before there was another number. And they decided in the 1970s to make that a definition. And they defined that 1 inch was exactly equal to 2.54 centimeters, thereby making a connection between the English system of measure and the SI system. They are actually the same unit of measure. Does everybody remember that now that I'm saying that? Does that stimulate your memory? So cool. So this one is exact for that reason, because this one is a definition that was set around the 1970s. So that is an actual definition. So when we see this, this is what I was concerned about, is that I think that when you guys were seeing the equal sign, that you're jumping in and saying, oh, because there's an equal sign, that's a definition. Not always true. For instance, F is not a definition. F is measured. And so what I'm going to say is that this one is actually the exception to the rule. That normally, when I have two different units of measure, and in this case, what I have is I have the, let's do the English system, and I have the SI system, that when they are two different units of measure, those two different units of measure are made by aligning two different rulers. And in the aligning of the two different rulers, they are measured quantities with uncertainty. Did I make that clear? That normally what we do is we take and we align the two different rulers. We align the SI ruler and we align the English ruler. And we look to see where the two line up. So what is the measurement that I am taking on each one of these? And we find the spot on the ruler where they align, and we call that an equal sign. But they are taking two different rulers with two different scales on them and aligning them, and therefore this is actually a measured quantity. The exception is the 2.54 centimeters to 1 inch, which was defined, because the two rulers, when they aligned them, were so close that they decided to make that a definition. So if they were both SI, they would be exact. If they were both English, they would be exact. But when I go English to SI, they are all measured except for that one. Does that make sense? Everybody on track with me? Okay. So F, E, F, G, H, and I. What about G? 15 students. Exact. I'm counting again. Yes. So 15 students is exact. My table has gotten off. We'll put the answer in there. What about 172 apples? Exact. Good. What about 173 grams? Measured. Excellent. Okay. So the reason that I wanted to put this one in here is that there were no decimal places in 173. And usually people see the decimal place and it cues them in that it's measured. But measured numbers don't always have to have a decimal place. Measured numbers can be a whole number and still be measured. It just means that the uncertainty resides in the ones position. So very good. Okay, Alex, there was another question. Are there other exact conversion factors between systems? No, not that we have right now. So for all of the other conversion factors, they are all measured. The only one that I am aware of right now that is exact is the 2.54 centimeters equals 1 inch. So that's your question, Alex. Awesome. Thank you for that. Can I explain more why I is measured? It's just because when I took the ruler, well, it's gram, so it was a scale. I could take a balance and put this guy on a balance, and it's not working for me. How do I explain this? The balance was calibrated to measure. Plus or minus 1 gram with no fraction. But still measured. In other words, it's just that it's the way that the balance was set up so that there, it didn't measure out to that level of precision that you got a decimal place. It only rounded to the grams place, but it was still a rounded number with uncertainty, and therefore it was plus or minus 1 gram. And it is the plus or minus 1 gram that makes it measured with the uncertainty that actually does it. So it's, I think the point that I was trying to make is that you can't always look at a number and assume that if a number doesn't have a decimal, that it's not measured. Many numbers that do not have decimals are still measured numbers. It's the way the number is obtained that is important. Was the number counted, or was the number measured using a ruler? That's the difference. So that's what we're getting into. So that's great. We can now tell the difference between a measured and an exact value. And measured numbers have significant figures. Exact values do not. Okay. And this whole idea of looking at the different types of numbers was to deal with uncertainty. And that's what we dealt with a lot in lab. So in terms of lab, what we had discussed was that when we do any sort of calculation, for instance, wanting to calculate an area, that's what we focused on the most. And this morning I started doing circles and other geometries to get away from cubes and squares and things. But we have a length and a width. And this length and width has a plus minus uncertainty. In the measurement. And because there is an uncertainty in the measurement, that uncertainty in the measurement translates into an uncertainty in the area of the box itself. And so we can draw a box that is maybe a slightly smaller box and a slightly larger box, and that this area that is in here represents the uncertainty within the area. So this is the uncertainty in area. And so it's important for us to understand the various uncertainties within individual measurements so that we can accurately predict the uncertainty within a calculated result. And that process or that system that we are utilizing is called significant figures. So significant figures technically is a system for estimating uncertainty in a measurement. We can say an individual measurement. And also a calculated result. So what we're doing there in terms of significant figures is that we'd like to be able to tell how many sig figs there are in an individual measurement, but then also how do we then translate those into the result of a calculation, and how do we get the right level of uncertainty in the result of a calculation. So those are the two things that we do with significant figures. And so we've already sort of talked about those significant figures to a great extent. For instance, we can just take some different measurements here, 0.00639 liters. We can have 234.9 feet. We can have 3.00 times 10 to the minus ninth seconds. And maybe I need another number here, which is 0.007200 milliliters. And so we'll just do an abbreviated list here and look at how many sig figs each one of these numbers has. And we remember that the sig figs is really about how we treat zeros, whether or not a zero is part of a measurement or not. And so it's all about looking at zeros, and that there are three different types of zeros. The three types of zeros are that we have a placeholder. Then we have a captive. And we have a trailing. And so these are the different types of zeros that we have. And with these different types of zeros, what we say is that placeholders are not significant. While these captive and trailing are significant and part of the measurement. So when we look at that, we can go and we can say, all right, how many sig figs are there in this first value? So we'll call this one A, B, C, and D. How many sig figs in A? I'll leave that definition of sig figs up just a little bit there so that you can see it. Three, yes. Okay, so we've got three sig figs in A. What about in B? Five, good. What about in C? Three, yep, I'm hearing it. Looking good. What about in D? Okay, I'm seeing mostly the right numbers there in D. D has four. Let me highlight the zeros, captive zeros first. There's a captive zero. I've only got one captive zero on the screen. Let me do placeholders. There are two placeholders there, and there are two placeholders there. And then let me do trailing. So trailing I did in red. This is a trailing zero and two trailing zeros there. Okay, so remember that placeholders are not significant. So we don't count the placeholders. So we only count the three sig figs that were in A. We're looking at it that way. The zero in B is captive, and so it's counted as being important and significant. So that gives us five. C, trailing zeros. The only reason to include a trailing zero beyond a decimal is because it is significant. So those trailing zeros are significant. That gives three sig figs. That's the three answer. This one is the one that is interesting. The two zeros that precede come after the decimal place, those two zeros are placeholders for the value of the 7200. But the only reason to include these zeros at the end of the reading is because these zeros are significant. Otherwise, the value would be the same. And so the only reason to include those two is because they're trailing, and that takes us to four sig figs. The only type of complicated ones then that we need to deal with is a value that is something like 2900. And then we could do the example of 2900 with a decimal place. And I could do 2.90 times 10 to the second. And so this would D, A, B, C, D, E, F, and G. Okay, how many in E? Two would be correct. We have agreed that there will be two sig figs in E. Jeremy, so the zeros in 3400 are considered placeholders and not trailing, correct? Unless there's a decimal. Jeremy, you're spot on. That is a correct comment. So excellent, Jeremy. What about an F? F, I've included the decimal, and so F there is four. And then G. Three, excellent. Okay, so yes, we are using the rule that says that when there is, let's see, what color did I make? Captive, I made blue. We're using the rule that says that when this decimal, that was not a highlighter, that when this decimal is present, that makes these zeros captive and makes them significant. Without the zero, these become placeholders for the value of 2900 without the decimal place. And then when we use trailing was red, when we put it into scientific notation, that one becomes a trailing zero, which makes it significant. I know that was all really quick, but I want to make sure that everybody's on board and doesn't have any questions, because I know that there's some people that are not in lab and have not had the benefit of the 2 days that we've been talking about this in lab and getting everybody on board. So if there's any questions, please come forward and throw them out now.
I have a question. So this is kind of relating to the lab from the morning, but I know that when we came up with the answer 100 for one of our problems, we needed to show that there was like two significant figures, so we put in scientific notation.
Correct, Maddie.
So, oh, actually, never mind. If we got an answer like F, and we needed to show that there was like four significant figures.
You could either include the decimal. So you could write it as 2900 as a decimal, or you could write it as 2.900 times 10 to the third, and that would give you the same four significant figures.
Okay, so we can do either one. It doesn't matter if that...
Correct. Either way is correct. Marisol, can I scroll back up to the definition of significant figures? Yes, I'll put that definition up there. Remember, too, that these guys are, the notes are also up online at chemed.study, and they're right there underneath the video so that you can get the notes separately, and they come down as a PDF, and they're available for you there as well. Bianca, do I have definitions for the types of significant figures? Definitions for the types? No. Oh, you mean like definitions for a placeholder versus a captive versus trailing?
Yes.
Not that I've written out. I mean, we could create definitions for them, but the wording on it is tricky. And so I try to do it by pattern recognition more than I try to do it by definition. But let me see if I can define what a placeholder is. I guess there's multiple types of placeholders, and there's no one definition. The definition would be very lengthy to cover all the different types of placeholders. Basically, if you can write the value in scientific notation such that it removes the zeros, then the zeros were a placeholder. Maybe that's the best definition, because that encompasses all the different types. So a zero that is removed when a value is written in proper scientific notation, such as 6.39 times 10 to the minus third, it removes the zeros, and therefore the zeros were placeholders. That's sort of the definition of a zero that is a placeholder. A captive zero is a little bit easier in that a captive zero is a zero that is flanked by two non-zeros. So the zero is between a two and a three, two non-zero values, and therefore the zero is a captive zero. A trailing zero is a zero that comes after a decimal and after all non-zero values. So a trailing zero precedes the decimal. It's to the right of the decimal, and it is also to the right of any non-zeros. In other words, there's no non-zeros that come after them. That's a trailing zero.
Thank you.
So those are my definitions that I would use for those. Okay. If we're all in agreement, then what I would like to do too is just to hit those rules for addition, subtraction, and multiplication and division real quick, just so that we have a record of those here. And so we look at sig figs in calculations. And we have different rules for multiplication and division than we do for addition and subtraction. And the rule for multiplication and division is, I think about this as A times B, maybe divided by C. This is what I did this morning. And that this is going into a mathematical function where we are doing the multiplication and division. And then I have an answer that pops out of this. And I could look at each one of these as having a certain number of significant figures. I can say that A has three sig figs, B has maybe 4 sig figs, and C has 2 sig figs, and that the value that has the smallest number of sig figs equals the largest uncertainty. And that dictates my answer, that they must have the same number of sig figs. So the answer has to have 2 sig figs required such that it has the same level of uncertainty as the most uncertain value that is going into that calculation. And so that's how we deal with sig figs for multiplication and division. The sig figs rule for addition and subtraction is based in place value. And that one's a little bit harder to, define. So let's do the rule for addition and subtraction. Here, what we're doing is this one is based on place value. So when I have values that I am adding, there's no other way to do it other than to show. I can't think of how to do this in the abstract. And then let me do and let's say that these are all centimeters that I'm adding up. So each one of these is in centimeters. And as I go through and do this and add these values all up, let's do the math really quick. 7, 3, 9, 10, 11. So that's going to be 3 and 1. Okay, so there's my value. What I think about when I do this is I think about taking a line and looking at where the uncertain digit is in each one of these measurements. And I move that line over to wherever the largest uncertainty is. In other words, the first value goes plus or minus 0.01. The second value is plus or minus 0.1. The third value, plus or minus 0.1. This one, 0.1. And the last one, plus or minus 0.001. And I take that line and I slide that line over. Come on, line. I keep thinking I have a lasso rather than a square. There we go. And I slide that line over until I get to the largest degree of uncertainty, which my line is going to need to be crooked. I don't know if I can tilt it. I tilted it. Okay. I slide that line over until I hit that largest degree of uncertainty, and that's where I need to do my rounding in terms of my result. And so the largest uncertainty is in the tenths position. There are 3 different values that have that uncertainty in the tenths position. And because it is the tenths position that goes up and down the most, I round to the tenths position. So the tenths position carries the uncertainty. And so I round to the tenths position. And so the answer that I would report there would be an answer that would be 13.1 centimeters would be the result that I would report. Now, if I went through and I did that with sig figs, I'd get a very different answer. Because if I went through and got sig figs, I'd have 3 sig figs, 1 sig fig, 3 sig figs, 2 sig figs, 1 sig fig. And if I used the rules for multiplication and division, I would have had to round my answer to 1 sig fig, But clearly here, I'm getting a 3 sig fig answer that is coming out of this. And that's because addition and subtraction is done by place value. So this is the critical component. This is by place value that I go through and do the rules for addition and subtraction. So that's consistent with what we did yesterday in lab and this morning in lab. Everybody feeling okay with that?
Yes.
Okay.
I have a question that's not quite about this.
Okay, what you got?
It was on when we're talking about significant figures and we're looking at E and F. What would be the 2900 without a decimal? How would you put that in scientific notation?
2900 without a decimal into scientific notation would be written 2.9 times 10 to the third.
And okay. And then F would be 2.900 times 10 to the third.
Correct. And it's written right there. Yes.
Oh, whoops. I didn't see that one.
That's okay. No worries.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. We're all good. Okay. So now we've gone through the rules of addition and subtraction, and we've gone through the rules of multiplication and division. And I think that what I want to do is look at the clock and say, hey, it's 11:15. We've been going for an hour. How about we take a 10-minute break? How does that sound to get your minds, give your minds a second to clear so you're not sitting in front of the screen so long? Let's take our 10-minute break. We'll come back and we'll do some more. Sounds good. I'll put some music on. All right.
Singing in the dead of night, take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night, take these sunken eyes and learn to see all your life. You are only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird, fly. Blackbird, fly into the line of a dark black night.
Yeah. said I heard of women like you. So I'm gonna tell you everything you wanna hear, but I'm gonna have my cake and eat it too. Now everybody knows how the story goes, 'cause people can't help but yakety yak. Now this young man's gotten old, don't you know he's all alone, and his baby, she ain't coming back, no. Said if you want it, go out and get it. Now if you love it, hold on to it, but don't you keep it just 'cause you think you need it, nah. But if
Superman. My eyes went ooh, my voice just cooed, my mind Drinking rum and Coca-Cola.
Okay, we are back on. Let's get started back here. I was still wrapped up in email. Darn emails, they'll have to wait. That's just the way it goes. Okay, everybody back with me? You guys were enjoying the music that worked. That's better than just dead air, I think. It gives us something to listen to while we're hanging out here. Okay, I'm going to re-screen share. We'll go back to the iPad, and screen start, and back to Notability, and it should come up. Nice, and it did. And what we need to do now is move into section 1.6, dimensional analysis. So section 1.6 is where we actually start using all these things. We start using all the sig figs and these rules for addition and subtraction. And dimensional analysis is a formal way of writing out a computation that is systematic in nature, that allows us to be able to use the units as a tool for writing out the calculation. And most of the time when it's taught, I feel that it is taught from a little bit of experimentation. And there's a system to it. And if you learn the system, it becomes a whole lot easier. And I think, too, that there's a lot of resistance in people to use the system. But if you use the system and you follow what I'm going to try to teach you, we use the system throughout, and throughout all the calculations and throughout the entire chemistry course and throughout Chem 1A and Chem 1B. And this system just makes it so much easier. It's so much easier than trying to just bludgeon your way through a problem. And it's pretty simple, actually, in the way that we set it up. So in dimensional analysis, what we do is we have a given unit. And we have a desired unit. And what we do is we use inequality. So we multiply the desired unit by what we call an equality. And the equality is written as a fraction, but essentially what the equality does is it uses this given unit and puts it in the denominator. So we have a value with the given unit. And we take the desired, this guy from over here, and we put it in the numerator, and we have a value that is the desired unit. And the units cancel such that what I get, when I cancel this unit here, I get the desired unit as an outcome. And this equality, this thing that I'm calling inequality, the equality is the value of the desired unit that is equal to the value of the given unit. And I know I'm trying to do this in abstract, but we're going to make it more concrete in a minute. So I have this desired unit, and it's equal to a value in the given unit. And equalities can come from all different places. Equalities can come from two different rulers added together. Equalities can be memorized. Equalities can be within the same unit of measure. All different sorts of things. Let's do a simple one just to kind of show how this works and how we put it together. So the question could be, how many inches are in 67.3 feet? So we'll just do an English measurement one. And the equality that we are going to use, the equality is that there are 12 inches equals 1 foot. And as we set the problem up, one of the things that I like to do is I like to introduce a roadmap sort of concept. And for this problem, the roadmap concept is going to be sort of simple. But as problems get harder, the roadmaps become extremely important. We are taking and parsing this problem, and we're seeing that the desired unit is stated in how many inches, that this is my desired component. And the other component over here, the 63 feet, this is my given. And so in my roadmap, I'm going to go from my given of feet, and I'm going to convert that using the equality into a unit in inches. And that's my roadmap. And the arrow represents the equality. And that equality is that 12 inches equals 1 foot. Now, I haven't written that equality as a fraction. I've written that equality as a statement with an equal sign. And that's important to me. It's important that the equality is written with an equal sign as opposed to a fraction. We can think of it as a fraction, and many of these conversion factors, what we call conversion factors, are written as fractions, but they can also be written as an equality. And the equality takes numerator, denominator out of the problem. It takes it and says, these two things are equal to one another, and use them as you need to in order to accomplish your goal. That's what the equality says. So now that I have my roadmap, now what I'm going to do is I'm going to take and I'm going to write down my given. So my given is 67.3 feet. And I am going to multiply that by a conversion factor, which is going to then give me some value that is desired in inches. And so following the model that I have up above, I'm going to take that desired unit of inches and put it in the numerator. And I'm going to take that given unit of feet and put it in the denominator. And then I'm going to look at my equality and figure out where the values need to go based on my equality. So what I'm seeing is that the value of 12 goes with inches. So I will go and grab 12 inches and put it with its proper unit in the numerator. And I will find the value of 1 foot and take and put it in the denominator with its unit. And now you can see that when I multiply feet and divide that by feet in the denominator, that the unit of feet cancels. And as the unit of feet cancels, I will have one unit of measure in the numerator, and that is my inches that I desire. And so I simply take 67.3 and divide it by 12, and I get the result. So 67.3 divided by 12 equals 5.608, and then a repeating unit of 3 that just continues to repeat. And then,
I'm not sure why we're dividing.
Because I made a mistake. It's me. It's my brain. Fixing it now. thank you for keeping me honest. We should not be dividing. We should be multiplying. Sometimes it's not as easy to talk and write and think all at the same time and make it all work out. Sometimes the mouth just starts going and just keeps going and the brain is on autopilot. It happens. I apologize. Times 12, and this equals 807.6. That is such a better answer. So funny. 807. I'm human just like everybody else. I'm here. I'm trying. We'll get there together. You guys will keep me on track. I appreciate it. Okay, so the last part of this calculation is going through and applying the sig figs rules and understanding that 67.3 feet was a measured quantity and that it has sig figs. So I generally like to track sig figs in purple just so that I can write down at the top of the measurement, and I don't always include the SF there to say that these are the sig figs. I just write them down in tracking the sig figs. But then I have to ask, what's going on with this conversion factor? Does the conversion factor have any sig figs that I need to worry about? And I'm going to get rid of some of these other things to make it a little cleaner. What about this 12 inches and 1 foot? What is this relationship between these two values? Is that an exact relationship or a measured relationship? Remember that inches and feet are in the same system of measurement. It's exact. Yeah. And so what I do is I write exact up here, or we could write definition. And what that means is that the exact or definition does not affect the outcome of the sig figs. We completely ignore that in terms of the sig figs. And so my answer will have to have 3 sig figs in it. And I will take and I will round the answer to 3 sig figs. And the answer that I will report will be 808 inches. And that implicitly means that it is plus or minus 1 inch. And that's how many inches I know, or how well I know that answer is to the ones position. Okay, so what we've done is a very simple example of how we use dimensional analysis and a process that we go through. And let me formally define that process for you, because most of these are word problems that we're doing. So how do I tackle and go through and do these word problems? I have a very scripted sort of way that I tackle them. So these are steps to problem solving. So my steps are, number one, parse the problem. In that, I'm saying identify the given.
Jason, what was the final result? 808?
808.
Thank you.
808. Parse the word problem, identify the given, identify the desired, and any equalities given. Number two, develop a roadmap. Number three, identify any required equalities that may need to be memorized, or find equalities if you do not have sufficient ones in the problem. So we may need to find, or we may need to remember, required equalities if not provided. And I'm going to put in parentheses here three keys. And we'll talk about the three keys in a minute, that I have three key conversion factors that I want you to memorize that makes every problem easier. So there's three key conversion factors that I'm going to ask you guys to memorize that won't be provided in a problem, but that will be sort of like at your disposal because it'll be in your head at all times. Once we develop the roadmap and we find all of our conversion factors, the next thing that we do is we write out and calculate the answer. And the fifth thing is apply Sig Figs rules. Last thing, box your answer. That's a suggestion. You don't really need to do that, but boxing the answer when problems get complicated is a nice, easy way to sort of like finalize the problem and say, this is it, this is my final answer, so that you don't have a whole bunch of work there and me trying to figure out where the actual answer resides. Okay, so parse the word problem, develop a roadmap, find any required equalities, write out the calculation, perform the operation with a calculator, apply Sig Fig rules, box your answer. Those are all the steps to going through and doing a problem. Why not multiply? Oh, no. Okay. Those are the questions. They're still there. All right. That was from me messing up before. Okay. Let's go through and do a slightly longer one and see how we might apply a slightly longer one. One that's common sense. We'll use a common sense one before we get into some more complicated examples. But let's do this. Let's calculate. So here's an example. Let's calculate how many seconds are in, is there a question?
Yeah, could you go back up for a quick second?
Sure.
Thank you.
Got it? Okay, calculate how many seconds are in 51 point, what do we need to do, 2 years. So how many seconds are in 51.2 years? And so we're going to parse the problem first off. And in parsing the problem, we're going to find our given. So the given is 51.2 years. And I'm going to try to be consistent that my given is always in blue. And my desired is always in the question, how many? So when I see that how many, the unit that follows how many is my desired. So we'll pick that up, and that's my desired unit. And then no equalities were given in this. So I've parsed it out, and I've got years that are starting off over here as my given. And then I've got a desired, which is all the way over here. And that desired is in seconds. And now I've got to get a roadmap to be able to get from years to seconds. Now, most of us probably don't have an idea in how many seconds there are in a year. And finding a conversion factor that takes us from seconds to years might not be a feasible thing. But we can break years down into a smaller unit of time. And we can think about equalities. For instance, I can think about and make a list of equalities that I can say that in every 1 year, that equals 365 days. And so I can break years down into days where the arrow represents that equality. So I can say that this is the first of my equalities. And using that, I can break days down into a smaller unit of time, right? So I can think about another equality that takes days, and I could take one day and break it down into a number of hours, can't I? That I know that within one day there's 24 hours. And so that represents my second ability to go from hours. Now, you still may not know how many seconds there are in an hour, but I could take and I could say that in 1 hour, there's 60 minutes. And so I can write another arrow here that takes me to minutes. That's my third equality. And then in my last step, I can now go from minutes. So in 1 minute equals 60 seconds. And I can then, that is my fourth step. And my roadmap got a little bit wonky and it's curved there a little bit, but you get the idea in terms of, I keep trying to work on this little tiny screen. I feel like I just need a little bit more space between things to make it really clear. Okay, so we've developed a fully fleshed out roadmap. So how do I think about the roadmap? Why do I think about the roadmap this way? When you're going to drive to somebody's house, you've never been there before. The first thing you do is you ask them their address, your desired, where are you going? And then you get on Google and you put that address into Google and Google gives you a roadmap. It gives you a turn-by-turn sequence of how you get there. If you've never driven there before, you don't know the neighborhood, you don't have any way to get there. If you just have the desired, you've got, great, I've got a location. I want to go there. How do I get there? You need a roadmap. The roadmap is your map to solving the problem. If you can write a roadmap, you are 99% of the way there to getting the right answer. The roadmap gets you there every single time. Because if you can't write these conversions and you don't know what they are, then you don't know how to get there. But the second you put an arrow down and you know what that conversion is, you know exactly how to get from step A to step B. The roadmap solves the problem for you. All right, let's take this roadmap and let's convert this roadmap into a calculation. So now what we're going to do is we're going to start off this calculation with our given, which was 51.2 years. And I'm going to keep my roadmap up there so that I know where I'm going. So this is 51.2 years. And I am then going to multiply this by a conversion factor, an equality, that puts years in the denominator and my first desired of days in the numerator. So what I'm doing is I'm following the same pattern. Years goes in the denominator and days, my first desired, the first desired winds up going into the numerator. In fact, I'm going to take this roadmap because I don't like this split screen. It's kind of not helping me. I want them in the same place and yet have enough room to be able to work. Okay. Now I think we're good. And we can still see our equalities. Go ahead.
It's another way to think of it. The idea that like we want to get rid of the years, or like we want the years to cancel out, so we just have days, and that's why we put the years at the bottom.
That is exactly why we're doing it. And that's why it's called dimensional analysis, is that we're analyzing the units and making the units cancel. And by putting certain units in the denominator, we then build conversion factors to be able to cancel out the units and move from one step to the next. That is exactly what we're doing with the system. Yeah. Okay. So the reason that I like to take and write these out as equalities, though, is that now that I've written it as an equality, that the equality up here doesn't tell me which number goes in the numerator or denominator. It allows me to use that equality as I need to based on what's going on in my calculation. See, sometimes equalities are given to you as fractions. And when they're given to you as fractions, students are confused as to, well, can I flip that over? It doesn't have the same value if I flip it over. But if you think of it as an equality, now there is no top or bottom. Now you can use the equality as you need to. So writing it as an equality is actually beneficial. And so what we'll do is we'll take 1 year, the one value goes with year, and 365 value goes with days. And I have successfully now converted years into days. Now I take the next step on my roadmap and move to step two on my roadmap. I'm going to take days and put it in the denominator, and my next desired hours and put it in the numerator. And I will consult my equality. One day equals 24 hours. One day, the one goes with days, 24 goes with hours. I have now successfully canceled days, and I am in units of hours. Next, I will take and put hours in the denominator. And if you're following the pattern, the numerator of one always goes to the denominator of the next. So I go from hours to my next desired minutes. And I consult my conversion factor, my equality, and for every 1 hour, it's 60 minutes. One last step, I go from minutes to seconds. And for every 1 minute, it's 60 seconds. And I have successfully now canceled out hours. I have successfully canceled minutes. And every unit has been canceled except for seconds, and seconds is sitting in the numerator. And so this calculation, when I input it into the calculator, the actual keystrokes that I'm going to input is I'm going to input 51.2. I'm going to multiply that by 365, multiply that by 24, multiply that by 60, multiply that by 60, and I'm going to get an outcome that comes out of this, and that outcome is going to be in seconds. So we go through and do that. 51.2 times 365 times 24 times 60 times 60. And I don't have to worry about the divided by ones. Those all take care of themselves. 161,464,3200 seconds. That's how many seconds the calculator spits out. All right, so I'm going to go back and I'm going to consult my list of things to do. I parsed the problem. I identified my given and desired. I developed a roadmap. I found conversion factors, equalities that allowed me to get from point A to point B. I wrote out my problem and I calculated the answer. The step that I'm at now is I must apply the Sig Figs rules. So now we'll go through and apply the Sig Figs rules to this. How many Sig Figs are there in 51.2, the value 51.2 years? Three Sig Figs in the 51.2 years. What about 365 days equals 1 year? How many Sig Figs in 365 days equals 1 year? I've got one answer in the chat. I'm looking for more. How many Sig Figs in this equality, 365 days equals 1 year? And you can look at it this way. How many Sig Figs in this equality? It's exact. It's a definition. Yes. Okay. So I think it was this that keyed you off, that as soon as I looked at that with an equal sign, you guys keyed off on that, that was a definition. You need to be able to see it this way as a definition as well, that there are exactly 365 days in a year. And so this is an equality. And so we're going to just write this as a definition, meaning that it doesn't affect the Sig Figs. What about 24 hours in a day? Definition as well. Yeah. And we'll find that 60 minutes in an hour is also a definition. And 60 seconds in a minute, also a definition. In fact, for this problem, there is only one value that contains Sig Figs, and it's three Sig Figs. And so my answer will appropriately be rounded to three Sig Figs as well. So I need to have a three Sig Fig answer. And that answer, as I write it out to three Sig Figs, is going to be 161,000000. making sure that I've got all the right numbers of zeros in there. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So that's the correct number of zeros. That's in seconds. And that is such a big number that I should really write that in scientific notation to make sure that we're getting it right. So that would be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 1.61 times 10 to the ninth seconds. That's a lot of seconds.
I have a question.
Yes.
We got the three sig figs from 51.2, right?
That is correct. That's where the three sig figs came from. Okay, so that many seconds, this value is of personal significance because I am now 51.2 years old, and that is how many seconds I have been on Earth, and that's a lot of seconds. Actually, I'm about to flip to a new power of 10 here pretty quick, and we're going to roll over to times 10 to the 10th. That'll be a significant moment. But anyway, I think that this exemplifies how to go through and do a dimensional analysis problem. We now have a process and steps for going through and solving the problem. Parse the word problem, identify the given and the desired, write down any equalities. And when you write down those equalities, write them down as an equality. It's helpful if you write them as an equality. And then once you've got that, sit down and write out your roadmap. Develop a roadmap of how you get from point A to point B. Oftentimes, on a test or a quiz, I will ask you only for the roadmap because I want you to develop that skill and practice that skill of writing out the roadmap. If you just jump in and you start going down the road and trying to write out the equation, yeah, some people can do that, but you know what? You're going to make mistakes more often than if you actually have the roadmap in place. So getting the roadmap, I think, is really a key skill set. And then once you've got the roadmap, then write out your problem, do the calculation, go back, look at your sig figs, round your answer, box it in, write it appropriately if it needs to be in scientific notation or not. That's the entire process. So you've got a process-driven way of getting to the right answer. Should we do a new one? Should we do another one?
I have a really quick question about what's a good answer. Do we need to show like what the difference in the answer could be, like we did with the other one where you do like the little plus or minus, like...
No, I don't require you to do that. I've been doing that consistently because it was a way for you to recognize that there were uncertainties within measurements. Okay. And I thought that it was helpful to see the uncertainty to understand why we were doing that. Otherwise, all numbers sort of look the same.
Okay.
But no, it's not required.
Okay, so like on a quiz or something, for example, that would be our final answer.
That would be your final answer. And you wouldn't need to put a plus or minus on it or anything.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. How about any other questions? This was sort of like a big example to go through. And so I feel like this is a good time that if there are questions about this process or questions about what we did here, this is a good place to get them answered. Just give you guys a second to think about it. All right. Let me think about another example then. Let's see, I got a drink here in front of me. I've got 12 fluid ounces equals 355 milliliters. Let's develop a problem from that. How many liters are there in a sample containing 536 fluid ounces of soft drink? I told you I make up a lot of problems on the fly. I just reach around me and see whatever I've got, and we see that what we can do with these and what problems we can make up. And I'm going to give you an equality in that on this soft drink that's in my hand here, it tells me that 12 fluid ounces is equal to 355 milliliters. And so that's my given equality that they gave me. And in this given equality, almost every single container that you look at is published with dual measurements on it. They have both the English measurements and the SI measurements. You can pick up any soft drink, any orange juice, juice or water bottle, or any solid food will have both solid measurements on it in grams and pounds. They always have dual measurements on it, and it's a great way to find a conversion factor. If you can't remember one, you pick up any sort of container and it's published right there for you in terms of the equality. And so now what we need to do is go through our steps and figure out what we need to do. So our given is in the 536 fluid ounces is our given. And so we'll get that in there. This is our given. Our desired, how many liters? So liters are my desired. In parsing that out, I've got an equality that's here. I may need one more equality yet. We'll have to see how we do with this. I'm going to go from fluid ounces, developing a roadmap. So my roadmap is going to look like this. I've got fluid ounces, and I'm desiring to go to liters. And what I have is a conversion factor or an equality that takes me from fluid ounces to milliliters. So I've got an equality that goes here. This equality, we can call equality number one. This equality takes me from fluid ounces to milliliters. And what I need is a way to get from milliliters to liters. So milliliters and liters are not the same, but is there a way, or can I think of an equality that takes me from milliliters to liters? Does anybody know how many milliliters there are in liters? It's in a thousand. It's in the definition of milli. Milli is 1/1000. So a milliliter is 1/1000th of a liter. And we could write this equality in two different ways. So we could say that there are 1,000 milliliters equal to 1 liter. Or a perfectly valid and equal equality is that 1 milliliter equals 1 × 10⁻³. There's that power of -3 liters. These are equivalent statements. They are both valid and can both be used in order to get me step number two. So I have a fully fleshed out roadmap now, and I have the equalities. My next step is to write out the actual calculation. So I'm going to take 536 fluid ounces. 536 fluid ounces. And I'm going to multiply by my first equality. That equality is going to take fluid ounces in the denominator, and it's going to go to milliliters in the numerator. And I will go grab those values. It was 12 fluid ounces to 355 milliliters. I'm grabbing that value from this equality here. That successfully allows me to convert fluid ounces into milliliters. I will then take and write out the second piece of that, which is I'm going to put milliliters in the denominator and liters in the numerator. And I have my choice now. I could write this as 1,000 milliliters to 1 liter, or I could write this as 1 × 10⁻³ liters over 1 milliliter. And they are exactly the same value. So this is an or statement here in the way that I could write this out. And that allows me to successfully convert milliliters into liters. I have one unit of measure, and that is going to give me a value in liters that is going to come out of this. And so writing it into the calculator, what I'm going to actually put into the calculator is I'm going to put 536 times 55. I'll skip the times 1. I'll divide by 12, and I will divide by 1,000. And then I'll hit the equal key. Or if I'm following the bottom pattern, 536 times 355 times 1, entering it into the calculator, I use the E or EE key in order to give me times 10. I hit the plus minus key, or sometimes it's a negative key in parentheses to give me a negative value. I enter the 3, and then I hit the divided by and do 12. These two calculations, when punched into the calculator, should give me the exact same result. 536 times 355 divided by 12 divided by 1,000. This comes out to 15.85666 reoccurring, and that is going to be in liters. The other result would come out exactly the same. Now, one of the questions that I typically get is, why did I do this? Why did I divide by 12 and divide by 1,000? When you look at the problem, the 12 is in the denominator. The 1,000 is in the denominator. What a lot of students want to do is a lot of students want to key it in this way, which is perfectly valid too. Here's another OR way to key it in. 536 times 355. Put these in parentheses. Divided by the quantity 12 times 1,000. Close quantity. Hit equal. This will also give you 15.8566 liters. The problem with this, and the reason I don't key it in this way, is because parentheses are an extra keystroke. Every time you put an extra keystroke in, you have another percentage of hitting a wrong key. It gives you the possibility of getting a wrong result just by happenstance because you're trying to put in more keystrokes. Getting rid of the parentheses, I can take and just type this in times 355, multiplying everything in the numerator, multiply, 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 divide, divide. Anything in the denominator, I hit the divided by key. It's 2 or 3 or 5 less keystrokes in every single calculation if I do it that way. And it just makes it a little bit easier. So multiple ways to key it into your calculator. You choose the way that works for you, however your brain works, however you feel comfortable, more power to you. You can do it however you want. The last step, once we do this, is to go through and check sig figs. So let's look back at our original problem. How many sig figs are there in the 536 fluid ounces?
3. 3.
Yeah, I was looking in the chat to see if they were going to pop up. That's a measured quantity with 3 sig figs. What about the 355 milliliters in the SI system to fluid ounces in the English system? What about these numbers? How many sig figs in these numbers? There'll be sig figs.
Definition.
They're not definitions. Definition is only the one for the 2.54 2.54 centimeters equals 1 inch. That's the only one that's a definition. When you have two different units of measure, they will always be measured quantities. So this is going to be 3 sig figs in the numerator and 2 in the denominator. And then the 1,000 milliliters to a liter, that is within the same unit of measure. That is both within the SI. So that one is a definition. So when they are, so this is definition. And the way that I'm seeing that is I'm seeing, all right, I've got, I don't know what the best way to do this is. I'm running out of colors and it's starting to look like Walt Disney threw up if I go too crazy here. Milliliters and fluid ounces, those are different units of measure. Whereas when I'm in milliliters and liters, those are the same unit of measure. Same unit of measure is a definition. Different units of measure, different systems would be a measured quantity. Okay, so the smallest number of sig figs, 2. So I come over to my answer, and I could have picked any one of them, and I round to two sig figs. So my final answer that's going to come out of this, my final answer is going to be 15.9 liters. And that is my final answer. 15.9 liters.
Isn't 15.9 liters 3 sig figs, not 2?
Yes. What time is it? Are we supposed to be done yet? I think we're supposed to be done now. Obviously, we're supposed to be done now. What the heck am I doing? 16. Oh, my God. I was doing so well right up to that point. I was batting 1,000. That just tanked. Okay. Minus 1 point to Jason for not doing his sig figs correctly. Yes, Jason can lose points too, so we can just keep a running total. Minus 1 for Jason. We'll leave that in the notes. We'll keep track of how many points I lose throughout the course. And yes, so it would have been 16 liters, 2 sig figs, rounded to the appropriate number. And so that's the system. That's how we go through and do it. And we'll find that these problems will get fairly complicated. We can do a few more complicated ones. I have one more thing that I need to finish. We won't do it today. We'll do it tomorrow. So chapter 1, I've got to do temperature conversions. And we'll talk about temperature conversions, but we'll do that tomorrow morning. And then we'll jump into chapter 2 and see what we can do within chapter 2. All right, we are now at 12:17. Class ends at 12:20-ish or 12:25. And I'm feeling like this is a pretty good place to stop without jumping into more. And that'll give us a few minutes to answer questions if you guys have questions. So go ahead and fire away and let me know kind of where things sit.
Is this kind of what our homework will look like?
Bianca, yes, this is similar to what your homework is going to look like, although your homework will also have other, it'll have just regular sig fig things where I'm asking you sig figs. It'll ask you about exact versus definitions. It'll ask you about counted values. It will ask you about doing calculations. I don't have very many of the roadmap ones. I'm going to have to put together a few more of these, but I definitely hit these in the homework in the book so that chapter 1.6, if you look at the homework that I assigned within Canvas for the book, the suggested homework, the majority of the problems were in this 1.6 chapter because this is where you need the most focus and the most practice.
Thank you.
Yeah, Autumn, go ahead.
I have a question. Say we had to round the 15.856, whatever, to 3 sig figs. Would it be 15.8 or 15.9?
15.9 because it would follow the greater than 5 rule rather than the exactly 5 rule. If we look at this, this has values.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
Yeah. So this has values that precede the, that follow the 5. And because of that, this is considered to be greater than 5. And so we round up. So
I was just looking that 8 was even, so I was thinking you round down, but I forgot there is a greater than 5 rule.
It's the greater than 5 rule. That's correct.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Anything else?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. Let me see. I'm going to do the 3 keys tomorrow. I'm not going to overwhelm you with stuff today. I think we're done for today. I'm going to call it there. So we'll bring in the 3 keys and then we'll do temperature conversions tomorrow. And we'll do a bunch of examples tomorrow. So that's going to be a good plan. Okay. And a question from Juan. Let's see. Not registered in any labs. Do not need. I don't know if I can still join them through links. Yeah. This is true for anybody. So anybody still listening and in the class, if you're not enrolled in lab and yet you feel that it would be helpful to you to get the practice from lab, you're more than welcome to join in on any of the Zoom links or watch any of the videos from lab at any point. It is no more difficult for me to have you joining in on that Zoom link and have you be present and having you contribute to the discussion and ask questions. So absolutely anybody is more than welcome to join in and sit within that Zoom chat morning or afternoon to be able to get some extra practice and to see sort of the practice that goes on there within the lab and how we do that. So yeah, you're more than welcome to. And you can go back and watch the videos that are also posted online for that matter. Those are open to you at any point that you would like to go and use those as well. Okay, Roxanne, still don't understand why the answer is two sig figs. And yeah, we can make that a little bit clearer, I think. Okay, so that what we have said within the sig figs rules is that when I take a look at each of the values that goes into doing the calculation, the answer can only be as accurate as the least accurate piece of data that went in. In other words, the smallest number of sig figs in a calculation with multiplication and division determines the number of sig figs in the answer. The smallest number is the 12. The smallest number is the two sig figs that are there. And you say, oh, wait, there's a one over here. Yeah, but that's a definition. The 1 liter equals 1,000 milliliters is a definition that does not affect sig figs. And so here, between the different units of measure, I had 3 in the numerator, 2 in the denominator, 3 in my original value. 2 is the smallest number, and so I must round the answer to 2 sig figs. That's where that comes from. Excellent. Any other questions you guys want to get answered before we call it for the afternoon here?
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Okay, if there's no more questions, I suggest that we adjourn, take a break for lunch before the afternoon lab kicks in, and I got to get back online for the afternoon lab. So thank you all. Thank you for attending. Thank you for your questions. I greatly value those questions. And hopefully everything is going well and you guys are getting what you need out of this. All right. And I'll see you guys tomorrow, or I'll see you in the afternoon. And I'm going to go ahead and end the session and wish you guys a good day. All right.